Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Chollin, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Today's episode dedicated to Peter, who sent in an email. Morning, Matt. Big fan of the show and not sure what all the fuss is about, re your face. Is it a red jacket for Labour, blue shirt for Conservatives and a yellow tie for Lib Dems? He's talking about the logo on the podcast. No, it isn't. They've got me to dress up as initially Alan Partridge, and now I'm slightly played by that photo. Peter goes on to say, however, one question about your face. Can you raise both eyebrows or just your right? Is the photo a mirror image? No, I can raise both eyebrows together and one eyebrow independently. More on that as we get it. Coming up on today's episode, the TV show Who Do You Think You Are? They won't be able to make it soon if they cancel the census. We look back over more than 200 years of asking the people of Britain, where are you now? Before that, today's columnists Carol Lewis and James Marriott on why nobody can build homes properly. And we'll take a look at what we learned this week. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can listen to me live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. But first, as we always do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned that if you get David Cameron and Keir Starmer together, the lads banter is off the charts.
You got any tips for him, Lord Cameron?
Plenty.
What might they be?
Get a plan.
But we've got a plan, he'll be pleased to know.
Great. We learned the truth about Peter Mandelson's dip of choice.
People said that when I was seeking the selection in Hartlepool, I went into a Hartlepool fish and chip shop and mistook mushy peas for guacamole. It was a completely apocryphal story. Yeah.
It's easy for him to say. We learned from comedian Al Murray why the SNP's Stephen Flynn always puts his hands in his pockets.
That's also an old stand-up confidence trick. That if you put your hands in your pockets, it makes you feel relaxed. Oh. So you then relax on stage.
Making a note of that for my tour. We learned that Yvette Cooper's had another one of her weird dreams.
The Home Secretary is just wandering naked round this chamber, waving a little treaty as a fig leaf to hide his modesty behind. I admit, he doesn't have much modesty to hide.
We learn that Lindsay Hoyle does not like watching Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Can I just say, we don't use props in this house. And I will certainly ensure that if you do need reminding, I certainly will.
We learn that Keir Starmer has a new, totally implausible explanation for why he told everyone to make Jeremy Corbyn Prime Minister.
I didn't think the Labour Party was in a position to win the last election.
That's all right, then. We learned that Rishi Sunak really loves his new slogan.
We have a plan, it's working, and with him we would just go back to square one. He doesn't have a plan, and it will be back to square one. He has no values, no conviction, and no plan. It is back to square one. He doesn't have a plan, and it will be back to square one.
And we learned that nobody should laugh at Lee Anderson.
The Labour lot was all giggling and laughing and taking the mic, and I couldn't do it in my heart of heart.
No laughing. No, please, no laughing at Lee Anderson. And please, don't read my column tomorrow and don't laugh at Lee Anderson.
The Columnists.
And as ever on a Friday, we are joined by James Mack. James, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. I'm beginning to wonder whether all these ancestor things have a bit of the tone of, you know, everybody is eventually related to Genghis Khan, if you know, go far back enough. Everybody's grandfather printed Lenin's leaflets.
If you're doing the census and going all the way back and looking at your family tree, there is a point, because the same thing happened when Danny died, didn't it? When he did
Who Yeah, it's like on Who Do You Think You Are? Everybody is related to the royal family. Yeah. So that I'm going to say, yeah, I'm a descendant of Genghis Khan. Highly evident in my personality.
Have you got any actual family claims?
No, Marriott's completely boring.
Is it?
Yeah.
Not even the chain of hotels?
Well, maybe. If I discover that, have you ever looked into that?
You not got a claim to a...
No, my dad does have a Marriott Hotel dressing gown, but that's like...
Stolen.
Stolen, but that's but that's the only family connection to Marriott Hotel chain, sadly.
And Carol Lewis is here because India Knight's not here.
Hello.
How are you? I've not seen you for ages.
I'm very well.
Do you have any extraordinary family claims to fame?
Sadly not. Although I was tempted to lie once in John Lewis when they asked if I was related to the family. But I didn't. I told the truth. I'm not related at all.
What would have happened if you'd said yes?
No, it's stupid, isn't it? It probably would have just given me the discount. There's no way I could have proven it.
Is there a family discount?
Well, you've ended up, there's a guy called John Lewis on Twitter who always gets tweeted at about the Christmas advert. So you could have ended up like him, bombarded with Twitter messages.
Because he's got the...
@John Lewis handle.
Yeah. And every year he gets, but then he replies them all, doesn't he? It's like an annual tradition.
Yeah, he's sort of become a bit of a micro celebrity out of it, so it could be exploited. I should have got the @Marriott handle. But.
Yeah. I think you should look into that.
I'm going to explore it.
I can see you running a hotel.
Yeah, me too. Like Faulty Towers.
Now, Carol, we talk quite a lot on the show about why as a country we can't build anything, you know, with his HS2 or his roads or whatever it might be. But we can't have the poverty edge of the Times here and not talk about building houses. And tell us what's happened in Cambridge.
So there's a development. There's a lot of developments around Cambridge because every time politicians want to announce something about building, they say build something in Cambridge. There's thousands and thousands of homes being built around Cambridge.
Because there's lots of high-techy, sciencey, laboratory-type jobs there.
Yes, and lots of half-finished building sites. Darwin Green is one of them. They've got a problem on the foundations on some of the houses that have been completed, so they're having to demolish them and start again. This isn't a one-off.
What was wrong with them?
There's something wrong with the foundations. Right. I'm not quite sure. Dodgy foundations, pretty major.
Yeah.
We've had a few lately where developers have had to pull things down, either because they didn't match the application to the planning authorities or because they've got a fault. There was one in, I think, southeast London somewhere where water had been dripping through the cladding. I'm not sure we've got more shoddy homes than we've ever had. I think it's always been a problem. We've always had a shoddy home problem. I think we're more aware of it since Grenfell. I think developers are probably more aware of it too, aware that they can't get away with it quite so much. But we spoke not long ago too. You know, when you buy a new home, you go around and you write a list of little things that need sorting out, snagging.
Yeah.
And it can be things like scuff, skirting boards, a little chip, but it can also be big things. And you should employ a company to do it rather than just go around yourself because you'll miss half of what's behind the scenes. And do you want to guess what the average is?
Well, how many snags?
How many snags on a new build home?
Oh, James, what do you think?
I'm. This is way beyond my pay grade. I've never bought a house.
Like 10?
160 is your average.
Average?
Average. It's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yeah.
But since Grenfell...
Because that's it must be like every house in the street has got all the same things on with it.
Also, we're not talking big houses. Most of the houses in this country are quite small than new builds. So, I mean, it's quite shocking. We've got to do something about it. I think the industry knows they've got to do something about it.
And what is it because of the economic... Because the thing that obviously baffles me is that a house is worth far more than the cost of the bricks and the literal...
It's the land, mainly.
So it's the land. Mm. But what profits are the house builders making? Is it because we... Madly, basically, the value of the land means that you can't build good quality houses? Or is it because the construction companies are being the middlemen, who are the ones who buy the land and build the house, are basically trying to maximise profit?
I think both of those are arguments. The developers would say their margins are too small because of the land prices. There's also the argument...
But they're the one driving up the price of the land, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you can go around in circles on that one. Yeah. There's also the new build premium is pretty hefty. And then when we saw Help to Buy, we saw another premium on top where you know, first-time buyers were being charged 22% more on top of the new build premium. So, You can get around circle.
Premium?
You pay more for a new build than you would for the same house if it were secondhand.
Do you?
Yeah, by quite a long way.
What would you rather live in, James? A new build or
definitely secondhand? Something nice and old and Victorian would be my dream.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there was a survey by the Chartered Institute Building not long ago. A third of home buyers wouldn't touch a new build. Mm. I mean, that's quite worrying when we're looking at trying to build more houses. I mean, Labour's saying 300,000. If no one wants to buy them, we've got a problem. We need to get our act together.
And they often look so ugly as well. That Cambridge development, I mean, it was quite good it got demolished because there's horrible little windows and... Yeah. Big blank expanses of red brick wall, which I think is, you know, quite, you see everywhere with this
quite
new...
boxy.
Just, why can't we make it nice?
I know, you sound like Prince Charles
well,
now, but
I
you've
know,
got a point.
Well, I actually went to Poundbury.
Maybe you're descended from Prince Charles.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. I went to Poundbury, his model village, last year, expecting to kind of scoff a bit and say, oh, this is all very twee. It was actually lovely. I really liked it.
Mm. So why can't every developer be a Poundbury? Is it because, actually, part of the appeal is... that all the houses have got fancy bits on and they're all spaced out, and actually if you want to maximise your money that you just can't do it? Or is it just... Because it is weird how when you drive around and you see new developments, yeah. You just look at them and think...
Just all at the same.
They're horrible.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm definitely of the opinion they should all be going more towards having proper design codes and looking like something you'd actually want to live in. Mm. And actually, hopefully, you know, being built properly as well. There's a new Homes Ombudsman and a new Homes Quality Board that were set up in the wake of Grenfell. But 20% of builders haven't signed up for the Quality Board, and virtually no one who buys a new BN home knows about the Ombudsman. It's set up to deal with 500 cases a year. I think last time we contacted them, they were dealing with 12. So it's about awareness as well.
But it's also amazing that a whole industry's cropped up of companies that only deal with drawing up lists of snagging. You wouldn't buy a new car and then accept, oh yeah, there's only 160 things wrong
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, exactly.
The wheel fell off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bought a new suit, but I've identified 160
hire a company
issues. They have to pay a company to come in and say, yes, we've discovered that the bottoms of the trousers have been sewn up, so you can't get your feet out.
Yeah. It's appalling. It's appalling.
That's interesting, though. That's interesting. But anyway, I was going to say it's a great story, but you just build nice houses. Anyway, let's move on, because everyone's always saying, why can't the politicians just sort it out? And normally, particularly loveys, there's nothing worse than a celebrity lovey slagging off politicians. And then yesterday, Mariella Frostrop was speaking to the Doctor Who writer and the co-creator of Sherlock, and he's got a play on right now called The Unfriend, Stephen Moffat. And she was asking about this, and I thought, oh, no, he's just going to go on about politicians. But actually, he said that politicians in the UK get a bad rap.
And I always find it quite funny that we are so instinctively cynical that we say, oh, they're all idiots and they're lazy. I don't think most of them are idiots, and I don't think most of them are lazy. I think the job is undoable. It's intractable. And it is an insane thought that that job would be better done by all the satirists and the comedians and the showrunners and the writers and all the people who slag them off. They couldn't do that job. They couldn't do one day of that job.
And I was listening to that, James, and I just thought, what a refreshing take.
Yeah, it's a good take. It's something I always feel so in two minds about, because obviously in Britain especially, we have such a long history of unbelievably scurrilous, rude and vicious political satire, which is in itself a good thing, and, you know, it means that we don't, you know, worship our politicians in the way that sometimes, you know, the French president can walk around acting like a god. But then there is definitely a downside where if we just always believe that politicians are stupid and we always think they're idiots and incompetent and corrupt, then I think that does begin to corrode our political culture a bit. And, you know, we can see now we have problems making people actually want to do that job.
Mm.
And you can kind of see why. Yeah, and it does satire go too far and end up, you know, making us not get the right people wanting to be politicians.
But it's good that we're cynical, though. I mean, as you said, it's good. And also, you don't want to watch sitcom about someone just working really hard, do you?
Yeah, that's true.
How do you make that work?
The thing of it would have been a very different show if it was just sort of people just sitting around having meetings going, great, well, that's going very well.
Really competent. Good ideas, yeah, executing them competently and agreeing with each other.
Yeah.
I don't think politics has ever worked like that.
But I suppose the problem with famous people who've got a platform for being able to tap dance, using that to then say, well, it's just obvious, isn't it? I don't know why they sound like this.
No, I want more celebrities like that.
But do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I come and it's
sort of, well, I just don't understand, George, why they don't...
Like social media Twitter just so encourages people to go on and say, oh, this is terrible, stupid, you know, whatever, minister, a billion likes, loads of followers, you're a campaigning hero, when actually you're just somebody who's...
And actually, the conversation we've just been having about housing, there are you know, it's really complicated.
It is, and then we've got this rotating door of, you know, 13 housing ministers in 10 years or whatever. I mean, they don't even get a chance to do the job.
But it's the sort of thing that someone will come up with, you know, a celebrity will say, well, it's not obvious, isn't it? They should just all the houses should look, but actually there are issues. And then if you do, you know, if you try to address one thing often, you create a different problem. And then you try to, you know...
Yeah, it's much, much more complicated than it seems on Twitter, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, it's interesting.
I wouldn't want to be a prime minister.
No.
And could we build a house, sitting here with our opinions about house building, but...
I did try to lay some bricks once.
How did it go?
I don't think it's a house you'd want to live in.
Are they still standing?
No. I think they were taken down immediately.
Demolished, and then they got the snagging people in.
But it was interesting. And actually, next week, we've got another exit interview with Robert Goodwill, who's a Conservative MP, who's standing down. And I've been really enjoying it, because we're sort of speaking to politicians you don't often hear from. And actually, he talks about the things he did... Yeah, when he was in Brussels and regulations on recycling electronic components, or when he was a minister and they, you know, changed rules on things. And you just think that, you know, there are people, you know, quiet, non-showy people.
Yeah, well, in the post office scandal, Lord Arbuthnot, you know, badgering away to...
Just keeping on and doing
those things
out.
So, yeah, that stuff does happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Very good, very good. What would you do with 25 million euros when an Austrian heiress is trying to give away her inheritance? A vocal advocate for global wealth taxes as well. Marlene Engelhorn joins us. Hi, Marlene.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. So why are you trying to give away all your money?
I'm not just giving it all away. I think we are touching on spheres of wealth in which I was just born. Like, just because of my birth privilege, I'm super, super wealthy. And I get to make decisions that affect people who don't get to be part of these decisions. So I think it's not just a private problem of how to spend money, but it's a public problem of how to distribute wealth to begin with. And since I'm not taxed on my wealth, there's no inheritance tax in Austria, there's no wealth tax in Austria, I have to make it happen on my own, because government won't go and get it, as it could and should. And so I'm distributing it via a civic assembly.
So how, just tell listeners how it is that you came about this inheritance. What does your family do?
My family sold a company, and in this company, a lot of people worked, and they never saw any of that, of the gains of whatever they produced, right? That was distributed to my family because they owned it. Sold it 1996, 1997. Böhringer Mannheim is what the company was called, pharmaceutical company. And it made billions in sale, and made my family incredibly, incredibly rich.
Which, like you said, you've then inherited through a fortune of birth rather than anything, but that you've done yourself. So what are you now looking to do? What's the plan?
So it's already like rolling. The team is doing all the work. I have to say, they don't even get enough attention for that. So thanks for the team. And so basically 10,000 addresses were picked at random from the central registry of all addresses in Austria. And we had the Foresight Institute, who handles all the data, apply that we get this sample, and we had to prove that there's legitimate interest. And they granted us that because the civic assembly, for which we needed this data, was supposed to discuss distribution, wealth distribution especially, and whether it was just or not just, and what this meant, and how it affected politics, society, economy, and what to do with that. And so we got this sample of 10,000 addresses, 10,000 invitations went out, and then people can respond to that. You will expect 5%, the Institute says, which would be around 500. According to a message I got from the director of operations of the whole project, we've already cracked that number. And then they will get a survey where we collect, like, not we, because I never get to see any of that data, but the researchers get the data to around migrational biography, gender identity, income, also attitude towards inequality. Like, if you think it's if inequality is unfair or fair. So that also that is representative of Austrian society. And then 50 people at the end will build the good council, is what the translation of the name is. And they will have to discuss all of that, create ideas, and get a budget of 25 million to distribute along the lines of this task. And the only criteria to get an invitation is you're at least 16 years old and you live and are registered in Austria.
And so they then will decide how the money is distributed.
Exactly. They get to decide what to do with this money. The only limits to that decision is it can't be anti-democratic, it can't be anti-constitutional, it can't be violent or threatening or harming life in any way, and it can't be for profit. So, yeah.
And how
they get to decide.
How much money will you be left with at the end of this process?
We'll see, because I also pay for everything, like all of the expenses, and the people on the council are paid because this is very important work that they're doing. And it's, so obviously they're going to I hope I say this right. It really comes out hard.
Yes.
They get paid.
And that is very important. Yeah. What do you think of this, Carl? Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's a good idea, actually, because it's getting people to decide how wealth is redistributed. Mm. Presumably they can't just all vote to spend it on a holiday. And it's important. And I can see Marlene's standpoint. She hasn't worked for that. Work for that money. She might feel differently if she was an entrepreneur and she's worked her butt off to get the money, but I can see her point that, you know, she shouldn't have 20 odd million. Presumably she's keeping some from herself. She's not leaving herself destitute.
Yeah.
And she's got an opportunity here.
Marlene, what do you do? Do you work? Is the plan to give away everything you inherited and then carry on working yourself?
Well, I'm currently working in terms of all the public speaking that I do, the advocating work and the organizational work of Tax Me Now, the initiative I co-founded to advocate for tax justice as rich people in that particular role.
Yeah.
I don't get a salary for that. So I'm going to transition into working. It's going to be interesting. I only keep a little bit of my inheritance to make sure that I get a smooth transition. And then I will redistribute everything else as well. Like, it's not just the assembly. That's one of the main tools, because it's the major, absolute major part of my wealth that they get to redistribute, plus the whole budget for paying for everything. But everything that's left after that is also going to be channeled into redistribution. The sooner the better, because we need change in our structures and systems, because they always develop. Society always develops. That's the only constant, is development. And to fund the people who are frontline and who do the work is really important, and not to sit on it. And then eventually I'm going to be one of the 99% who are working and paying their taxes. And I think this is finally my ascending into democracy out of this soup of wealthy, feudal, grab on my wealth kind of class.
Well, it's amazing. James, if you had 25 million euros, would you give it all away and get a proper job?
No, I don't think I have the moral strength of character. I think it's amazingly commendable. Especially because I was reading some statistics recently. Actually, I think giving from very wealthy people is declining over the 21st century. And we used to have this paradigm of billionaires like Bill Gates, who would secure their reputations by, you know, giving away tons of money to charity. And now it's people like Elon Musk who want to build rockets and stuff. So I think it's against the grain in a good way. And also, you know, one of the criticisms of Bill Gates is that one man has this enormous power to choose whatever he wants to make better in the world and then enact it. But yeah, the sort of democratic thing is kind of amazing. I'm in awe. I wouldn't be doing it.
What would you do with it?
Gold, you know, lovely gold bathroom and all the sort of stuff.
I'd be completely vulgar about it. On that subject, somebody's just sent, a listener has just sent in a message saying, do you have a gold toilet? And what's the most expensive thing you've ever bought?
My toilet is not something that I decided on, because I rent my flat, and so it was in, and I'm happy I have one. I'm happy that there is all this societal development to bring this into flats. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. But it's not
most
gold.
Most expensive thing. I recently paid for, it's called a climate ticket. It's very, very expensive. It's 1,100 euros, and it grants me to go on every public transport in Austria, whenever, wherever, all the time for a whole year. And I think it's a very, very cool ticket for then traveling climate friendly. I can afford it, so I paid for it, and I'm very, very happy to have it.
Marlene, I can't help thinking you're basically just a much better person than I am. what's the process of all this? When will it all? When does this process end, or at least the people, you know, some of the money start being paid out?
So they start the sessions. 6 weekends for these people are going to be starting in mid-March, and the end is expected at the beginning of June, and it's going to be publicly told to, like, what is the word? There's going to be a public press conference. Announced is the word. It's going to be publicly announced what's going to happen with the money, and then this decision, whatever it's going to be, a fancy Excel spreadsheet, a paper, I don't know, It's going to be, well, I don't know, I don't get to decide. So it's going to be assigned and handed to the people who are in charge of then going to the bank and distributing that money, because it's not going to be on my account. Yeah, I put in an account and then trust it with three people who then, as the three of them, will distributed according to what the assembly decided.
Oh, fantastic.
Carol Lewis and James Marriott there, and you can obviously read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, the life and times of the census.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Thing.
Who do you think you are? As I know from personal experience, if you want to find out where you come from, to climb up your family tree, you need the results of the census.
Let's jump into the actual census proper. And can you see third from the top with the red asterisk? We have Edward Milden. And then can you see the next word?
Convict.
Your Majesty's prison in Portland.
As the records show, it was born more than 200 years ago. And thanks to the census, we know how many Jedis there are.
So Jedi is a person who follows the ideology or the idiosyncrasies of the Jedi Knights in the Star Wars universe.
That a suffragette hid in a parliamentary broom cupboard.
And when she was found, it meant that she could say on census night, her residence was the Houses of Parliament.
And has helped to record the changing lives of us and our ancestors. But is it now about to register its own death? Yes, a consultation is underway on scrapping the census, the survey we do every 10 years, which tries to count everyone in the country and ask them about their lives. Well, Sir Ian Diamond, the UK's national statistician, wrote in The Times last year, "We've reached a point where a serious question can be asked about the role the census plays in our statistical system." In a moment, we will hear from a genealogist. We'll also find out what happened when I went down to Parliament, where there is that cupboard where Emily Wilding Davison hid. And we'll dive into my own family tree. But let's speak to someone who uses the census, well, all the time. The Times data editor, Tom Calver, is here. Tom, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
So very good, very good. So it's every 10 years. England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland have different ones. So it's a consultation about the future of the one in England and Wales, where the assumption is if that one goes, the others will follow. Is the census, because it's quite old-fashioned, that every day everyone fills it, you know, on the same day everyone fills in a survey at the same time. Is there still a place for it, or should it be scrapped?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for having me on. I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, cast your mind back to 1801 when the first census happened, and there basically wasn't much information or data out there at all about, like, who was living in Britain, what kind of work they were doing. And so suddenly the census comes along, and all of a sudden the government has all of this very useful information. Now, of course, our world is absolutely teeming with data. And I think the important point here is that you don't have to wait 10 years at a time to find out what's going on with the people of Britain. For example, if you change jobs, the government knows pretty much straight away. If you have to join an NHS waiting list, that data is recorded as well. In the 21st century, a lot of people sort of say that, you know, getting one census, one big dump of data every decade just looks a bit, well, inefficient.
Are there, because I suppose the other thing is that knowing that we are definitely going to get all that data, because obviously at different times, different government departments pick and choose
what they do and don't collect, and we might start finding gaps in it. Having that once every 10 years, maybe if we could do it more often, given technology. But having that, okay, this is an actual snapshot of how many people are here, where they live, what they do, their family independence and all of that, does actually have some use.
Yeah, it is incredibly useful. I mean, people like myself, I mean, it's almost like Christmas, but if Christmas was once every 10 years, it's like a mega
a
Christmas.
Really mega Christmas, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the census isn't perfect. I mean, the reason we should care about it is, you know, it's obviously very important for governments to know exactly, you know, who lives where, for things like planning home building, planning hospitals, planning GPs, all of that stuff matters. But, you know, ultimately, the census is only as good as the people filling it in and the kind of questions that they're being asked. I mean, in 1871, for example, people were asked if they were a lunatic, imbecile, or idiot. 30,000 people said that they were. So, you know, throughout the census history...
I think this is a question we should still be asking now.
Well, perhaps you're right. But, you know, I mean, throughout the census history, changing the questions has sort of framed people's responses to it. So it's far from perfect. I mean, a great example in the recent census is how in the 2021 one, when they asked about nationality, they changed the order of the answers. So they moved the top answer used to be English, now it's British. And all of a sudden, the number of people recording that their nationality was English plummeted in that 10 years. Now, some of that fall might be genuine. What's probably going on, actually, is that people just pick the first answer they see. So, yes, there are some problems with the sort of the human-designed surveys. And, you know, they're only as good as the people filling them in as well.
And there was also controversy in the last census over the gender question. For the first time, they asked about if people had a different gender to their sex at birth. Is the gender you identify with the same as your sex registered at birth? And there's been some debate as to whether or not people really understood the question. And so as a result, how useful the answers are.
Yeah, exactly. All of that stuff really matters. I mean, I think moreover, though, you know, in terms of what will actually replace it, you know, there are several suggestions that we could almost move to this sort of Norway-type model, right, where you kind of have this live population register where all these kind of data sets on things like taxation, benefits, but also your age and sort of personal information are linked together. But I think, you know, the problem with that is that what the census has become very good at recently is asking exactly those kinds of sort of identity-type questions that the really interesting bits of the census. So the things about, as you would just say, gender identity, but also nationality, also about your sort of attitudes to other people. And, you know, it's sort of a worry that actually you wouldn't get such an interesting census if you just restricted it to the boring government data that anyway.
There's a sort of social aspect to it rather than just the sort of numbers, because, you know, they use the numbers for how many houses do we need, or what's the, you know, school intakes and that sort of thing. That is the information they probably can get from elsewhere, but there's the social side. And I suppose, actually, it's not clear that if we got rid of the census, would researchers in 100 years' time be able to build a family tree in the same way, where you can go, okay, that, you know, that they lived there and they had three children, that's the name of the child, and then they were there, and then we can, you know, and being able to build up that picture of history might not be so easy from sort of disparate bits of NHS databases.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably what they would have to do is to tie it all together in some way so that it would be easily searchable for researchers. And I personally, I think, you know, that the demand for open accessible data will only grow over time. So I don't think we'll see the end to the sort of, you know, who do you think you are style family research. But yeah, it is a worry if all of a sudden you lose that sort of exciting sort of chunk, that sort of fixed point in history where everything is recorded.
Tom, really good to see you. Tom Carver there, The Times' data editor, taking us through how the census is used now. As you were saying, dates right the way back to 1801, that when it first began, it was a means of assessing how many men of fighting age were available in the country to serve in the Napoleonic Wars. Since then, it's asked different questions, and some of them have come and gone, but the very act of the census has also become, at times, a very political act. One of the most memorable moments in the history of the census relates to a broom cupboard in the Houses of Parliament. So I popped down to Westminster to take a look.
So heading away from Central Lobby, down the steps into Westminster Hall, which is where you'll remember the Queen Lane State and lots of very famous people have addressed both Houses of Parliament. It's just off to one corner, down from Westminster Hall, is St Mary's Undercroft, the Chapel of Parliament. And it's tucked away in a corner is a broom cupboard, which made history in the census in 1911. Now, as we've been discussing, every census, the main job is try and capture all the information of where everyone is and who they are and their lifestyle at that exact moment on census day. And on census day in 1911, there was a protest from suffragettes, as much as anything, about the fact that they couldn't be registered as head of their own household. And so Emily Wilding Davison, on that night in 1911, she crept in through Westminster Hall into the Chapel of St Mary Undercroft. In fact, in a corridor there is a broom cupboard, and she hid in the broom cupboard. And when she was found, it meant that she could say on census night her residence was the Houses of Parliament, and she was, for those purposes, the head of the household. Fast forward then to, what, 1991, around 1991, and Tony Benn followed up with another bit of, if not illegal, certainly controversial behaviour. But to mark this act, he put up a plaque on the door, and the plaque reads, "In loving memory of Emily Wilding Davison." In this broom cupboard, Emily Wilding Davison hid herself illegally during the night of the 1911 census. She was a brave suffragette campaigning for votes for women at a time when Parliament denied them that right. In this way, she was able to record her address on the night of that census as being the House of Commons, thus making her claim to the same political rights as men. Emily Wilding Davison died in June 1913 from injuries sustained when she threw herself under the King's Horse at the Derby to draw attention to the injustice suffered by women, by which means was democracy won for the people of Britain. And then underneath that, there is a further message which says, "Notice placed here by Tony Benn, MP, with the message, I must tell you, Mr. Speaker, that I'm going to put a plaque in the house. I shall have it made myself and screwed on the door of the broom cupboard in the crypt." And in fact, 10 years later, he told the House of Commons, Tony Benn, "I've put up several plaques, quite illegally, without permission. I screwed them up myself. One was in the broom cupboard to commemorate Emily Wilding Davison, and another celebrated the people who fought for democracy and those who run the house. If one walks around this place, one sees statues of people, not one of whom believed in democracy, votes for women or anything else. We have to be sure that we are a workshop and not a museum." And so that is how a broom cupboard just off Westminster Hall here in the House of Parliament made history when it came to the census in 1911. And in fact, after going down to Westminster, I rediscovered that actually Jeremy Corbyn claimed that he carried the toolbox and helped Tony Benn put that plaque up. Now, from from the sublime to the slightly ridiculous, we're going from suffragette broom cupboard to this. Are you a Jedi? It's an important question. As thanks to the census, we know that in 2001, 390,127 people, almost 0.8% of the total population of England and Wales, stated their religion as Jedi, surpassing Sikhism, Judaism and Buddhism, and making it the fourth largest reported religion in the country. The Charity Commission does not consider Jediism a religion. It still claims more UK adherence than Scientology. Well, let's speak to a Jedi and find out just how many there really are. J.H. Tapley, a Jedi Master, no less, joins me now. Hi, Jay.
Hello there.
So, tell me about being a Jedi. And I want to preface this with saying that some of my closest family members are huge fans of Star Wars in a way that I'm not. So, sell to me being a Jedi.
Okay, so I would say it's a basic survival instinct in people kicking in. Because even though it was something like movies, if there wasn't a grain of truth, people wouldn't resonate with that. You know, people would not believe complete lies, something completely made up, which means that there is something that speaks to them on a deeper level. And with this kind of numbers, that has to be something quite strong. And so I would say right now, if you look at the world, there is a lot of uncertainty going on, and the world is becoming a more threatening place, I would say. And so people naturally want to feel empowered. They want to be connected with something greater than themselves. And where the old religions were fading them in some regard, let's say they were less applicable, maybe they were just not as clear, maybe they were not as practical in everyday life, they watched someone apparently just like them, wielding reality, bending reality, using the power of his or her own mind. And it seemed so close to home because we are not just purely physical beings. We are both physical and quantum spiritual feeling beings. And so, of course, that truth resonated with people, and I don't blame them for that.
So what would be the, what's the sort of the life rules that you would live by if you were a Jedi?
Okay. I would say put your mind, your spiritual part first and your physical part second. And now, even from science, we know that our mood and our mind influences our body, influences our health, influences how we make decisions and ultimately live our life. So putting your emphasis on your spiritual part and also on something that is greater than you, on the force, God, light, makes your life experience a lot more empowered in many ways.
And I've been told you've got your lightsaber there with you.
That's right, I do.
And you, can I you do tricks?
I have two lightsabers.
You could do tricks with them.
Yes, I do. But also, I was just going to. These days, they make them sing. And I don't believe that weapons should make.
Oh, there it is. Like there we are. Yes. Right. You don't think they should? Well, that's the whole point of a lightsaber, isn't it? Is it supposed to make a noise like the films?
Oh, they should make the buzzing sound, yes, yeah. But not the singing sound.
No, not the singing sound.
Yes. So I used to run a lightsaber choreography club in London. And it was just something that people really resonated with. I teach meditation as well. I've been a spiritual teacher of 20 years. And so I just see how people in times of uncertainty, in times of turmoil, naturally develop that affinity to the divine inside them. Because what do you do? You know, in many aspects, the world has become a darker place. And so back then, back in the time, you could believe that authorities, the government, perhaps look after you, but it's no longer so. So what do? You want to feel protected. You want to protect your family. So you learn to use the force. You learn to build bend reality instead.
Now, every decade since 1801, people across England and Wales have taken part in the census, which underpins everything from funding services to the calculation of economic growth to helping plan schools. Well, how important is it? And obviously, one of the other great things about the census is you can build your family tree with it. The genealogist, Elsa Churchill from the Society of Genealogists, is here. Hi, Elsa.
Hiya, how you doing?
I'm very good. You must blooming love the census.
It is the most amazing resource because from 1841, every 10 years up to 1921, you get a snapshot of your families and the communities they're doing, finding out what's going on in their lives. And it's so democratizing. Everybody should be in it.
And what's just give us a sense of the sort of thing we'll find. Well, listen in a minute to what happened when I found out about my great grandfather. The sort of things you can find just from the core information of the census.
Well, I mean, the core information is from year to year. They give you their names, ages, and from 1851, the relationships, their occupations. And then as the government wants to know a bit more about what's going on in your lives, you might find out how many rooms they were living in. And because in 1901, they were interested in the social conditions and the living housing conditions. And then by 1911, they might ask how long the couple, if they were married, had been married and how many children they had had and how many children might have died because of they were interested in child mortality. So these snapshots of what you know, maybe statisticians want to find out, are actually thinking, gosh, my ancestors lived through that. Those are the conditions they're in there.
Okay, stay there, Elsa, because I'll come back to you in a sec. But this is what happened not long after Times Radio launched, actually. We got lots of presenters had bits of their family tree looked at. This is the genealogist, Simon Pearce.
We're going to have a look at the life of your great-great-great-grandfather, Edward Milden. Edward was born in the early 1820s. Some sources say 1820. in Bishop's Linton in Devon. And the family largely stayed in a close radius, you know, going to Molland and to Nalston. I'm showing you here an extract from the 1851 census. So anyone that's doing family history, these are a great source for building out the lives of your ancestors. Where were they living? Their occupations? How old were they? Where were they born? And can you see here that we have Edward, head of the household. So he'd already married his wife, Elizabeth, being leave in about 1843. And here we can see them. I believe they're in Nalston by this point. Edward's a farmer, agricultural worker, of course, you know, a huge part of the industry in this area, with their children, a few servants there as well, and visitors in the household. But it's just, this was helping me to kind of establish some foundations. Who was this person? Where were they from? And the same very much in the 1861 census. You know, you see them here all, you know, on the same page with their neighbours. Sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to read, but it was the next census. I jumped forward into 1871, expecting to find the family in a similar area. I was quite surprised at what I found. Maybe you'd like to read out the middle section for us.
Is it Portland Dorset?
That's right. It's actually a Portland convict establishment.
Portland convict establishment. What does that mean? Was he in jail?
Well, if you see the census, so let's jump into the actual census proper. And can you see third from the top with the red asterisk? You have Edward Milden. And then can you see the next word?
Convict.
In Her Majesty's Prison in Portland.
Do we know why?
Yes, we do. So anyone who's researching ancestors that have had brushes with the law, we need to look in the criminal records. Really, really interesting collection. So can you see the first entry here?
Yep.
It's for 1864. This criminal record has offences, the court proceedings. So can you see the middle, the conviction in the middle?
Sheep stealing.
And here's the sentence on the right.
And he got 12 months for that. But then you said, what was the gap between this conviction and then being in prison?
We're going to come on to that in a moment, the timeline. But I'm just going to give you a little bit of context around what's happened here. So anyone researching anyone, an ancestor in the criminal registers, the newspapers are amazing for a little bit of context.
A bit of court reports, exactly, the local papers. That's what we like.
Exactly. Now, I've highlighted a few sections, very, very long article. So I picked out the main points that I'll summarise. Would you mind just reading out the red section there for us?
Okay, so it says, Exeter Crown Court Wednesday, sheep stealing at Molland, Edward Milden, brackets, on bail, an elderly man, was charged with having stolen a ewe sheep, the property of Mr. W.M. Elworthy at Molland, in the month of August or September last. Mr. Turner prosecuted and Mr. Carter defended the prisoner.
Elderly is a little harsh because he's in his early 40s, but, you know, it's the wording of the times. We have another section here explaining what happened. Basically, Edward's being accused of stealing a sheep. He has taken a sheep from a farmer, presented it to another party, asking them if they could look after it for him for a small fee, pretending it was his, essentially. But can you read the bottom section here from his lordship?
This is the judge speaking.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So his lordship went carefully through the evidence, advising the jury to direct their attention to the charge of stealing without reference to that of receiving, knowing it to be stolen. The jury found the prisoner guilty, and his lordship sentenced him to 12 months imprisonment with hard labour.
Story doesn't end there. We know that he was given 12 months in 1864, but was still in prison in 1871. So what happened? Another entry in the criminal registers.
Yeah.
A little difficult to read his sentence, but can you see what that says?
Larceny by servant.
So stealing from your employer. That's a serious crime. Now, he has a previous conviction, as we know. And can you see here the sentence he was given?
7 years. So that's how he was in prison for so stealing from your boss is much worse than stealing someone else's sheep.
I have a newspaper article with a bit of detail if you're interested here.
Oh, here we are. Stealing coal at Tiverton. Edward Milden, Anne Palfrey and Thomas Palfrey were charged with stealing a quantity of coal, the property of Mr. Bede and a gentleman living near Tiverton. Milden pleaded guilty. He was in the employ of the prosecutor at a short time since he was sent to Tiverton for some coal with a horse and cart. On returning with his load, he was seen to stop at the house of the prisoners, a wayside cottage, and to take something from his cart, which he handed in at the door. So he was off to buy coal for the boss, but he took him out of someone's house instead. Both the prisoners denied their guilt, but the jury convicted them. Milden was sentenced to 7 years penal service. The others got 2 months in prison each with hard labour. I mean, he got a much tougher deal out of that, even though presumably they were all in on it, but he was the one who was diddling his boss.
And he had a previous conviction, which didn't help. So tough time for Edward. Starts off in Pentonville in 1868 after being convicted. Then 1869 is sent to Portland Prison in Weymouth. And he was stone dressing, cutting off blocks for the Portland Breakwater Fort. Tough work. Edward was discharged on license in 1874 for relatively good behaviour. and returned to Devon. I mean, returned essentially to normal life, if you like. And I have him here in the 1891 census. You have Edward Milden. He's a lodger, so he's not living with his family. And his wife sadly died in the mid-1860s. His children have gone their own way. He's a farm labourer back in Elston. So you wonder how many people back in the village knew of his commission of his past.
That was Simon Pearce from Ancestry, who looked into the darker side of my family. There was a war hero, I was told as well. We've still got Elsa Churchill, a genealogist here. Elsa, somebody's just messaged in. Trevor says, please can we ask how we can look at the census info? So it's one thing doing the survey itself. How and when do we get access to it? How can we do that?
The records become available after 100 years. And the original records are housed with the National Archives for England and Wales and the similar authorities for Scotland. The records themselves, because they're so important, have been made available on all of the genealogy subscription websites. So the big sites like Ancestry, Find My Past, The Genealogist, etc., etc. So if you've got a subscription to those, they're available to you. Or you can access them through your local library, or maybe even through a library like the Society of Genealogists in London. That's for all the censuses, apart from the most recent one, which came available, the 1921, is still under license exclusively to Find My Past, because they work with the National Archives to do all the work of conservation, digitisation, and then making it available online. So they have the exclusive right to use it for a few years before all the other big sites get it. So the censuses are pretty available online through lots of different ways, and you can search them by name and place and to identify your family living together and find out, as in your family, they're not where you expect them to be, they're in different places, in your case in prison, in my case they weren't even in the country because I realised when they, in 1851, they disappeared because they'd been transported to Tasmania. So we all have our rogues and vagabonds in our family, if you dig deep enough, and it's the skeletons that keep the stories alive and make it much fun to start looking.
It is absolutely. And it's such a, it's a fascinating thing. It's a weird thing when you just sort of, because obviously you never met these people, but having that blood tie, and suddenly it sort of brings some history to life as well. Elsa, it's lovely to speak to you. Thanks so much for coming on. Elsa Churchill, genealogist from the Society of Genealogists, taking a look at the census for us. The Office of National Statistics consultation is ongoing, so as and when they make a final decision on the census, we'll no doubt talk about that in the future. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget, if you're a Time subscriber, you'll get a bonus episode every Saturday. Just link up your Times account with your Apple Podcast subscription. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.